failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
My name is Dean Becker, and I welcome you to this edition of Century of Lies. Today, we'll hear from Daniel Williams, the author of The Naked Truth About Drugs. We'll hear from Terry Nelson, a former border agent, customs agent, and now member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We'll hear from Glenn Greenway on the Poppygate Report. And we'll hear from Jeremy Bigwood, who has produced a report discussing the U.S.'s proposed idea of using mycoherbicides in Colombia and Afghanistan. First up, author Daniel Williams.
I'm a 55-year-old retired cellular communications executive, and I currently live in Bonita Springs, Florida.
You are also the author of The Naked Truth About Drugs, I think a wonderful book that exposes much of the fraud behind this policy of prohibition. Tell us, what brought you to the point where you wrote this book?
Well, I've always been an advocate of repealing drug prohibition. It started back in the 70s, early 70s, when I was a college student and was arrested for the possession of marijuana two times, once in my junior year and once in my senior year. But it wasn't until I retired from the business world back in 95 that I turned full-time to advocating the repeal of drug prohibition, which led to me writing The Naked Truth About Drugs.
And it's kind of a recounting of the history. It's kind of a recounting of the hysteria. Tell us about the book, how you bring focus to bear on the hysteria.
Well, what I first try to accomplish in the book is to give an overall view of civilization's long association with drug use. And I put a particular emphasis on the United States, specifically in the late 1800s and in the early 1900s when we passed the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, which effectively ushered in drug prohibition and put all of these drugs on an illegal status.
When you talk about making these drugs illegal, you're talking about a trade. The government and the authorities, the powers that be, set forward the premise that by trading our liberty to decide what drugs we put into our bodies, we would be more secure. Tell us how that process has failed.
Well, that was the premise, to prohibit drugs to ostensibly make us a freer and a more later a drug-free America. The premise and the promise both were failures, as almost any thinking person out there can see the mess that we've found ourselves in now here in the 21st century after nearly 100 years of failed drug prohibition.
I think it a bold statement you made this book. You did a very much a mea culpa. You talked about your drug use over the years. You talked about its impact and your observations. Tell us about the various drugs that you've used and, again, those observations.
Well, I don't know if I would categorize it as a mea culpa per se. I don't brag about my 36-plus years of recreational drug use, nor do I apologize for them. I first began smoking pot in 1970 because my body was unable to process alcohol. I didn't ever get the taste for it, and a friend of mine turned me on to pot in 1970, and I thought it was a pretty good deal, and I continue to think that way. A year later, I took my first hit of LSD, and those are the two drugs that I primarily consume yet today, 36 years later. But throughout that 36-year time span, I tasted and tested virtually every drug that you can mention and probably one or two that you can't. But what I have found is that my story isn't all that unique. Perhaps I may have done more drugs than the average recreational drug consumer, but my story remains pretty much identical. People have been doing recreational drugs for a very long time in our country, and by and large, the experience has been pretty much no harm, no foul.
And that is the point. I thought the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution brought forward that we are given that right. I don't think it occurred to the founding fathers that someone would someday make these drugs illegal, because after all, they were writing on hemp paper, right?
That's exactly true, Dean. Our founding fathers were pretty bright in a lot of ways, and through the decades after we declared our independence, there have been various attempts at prohibition on certain substances. Probably the most commonly known one was our 13-year prohibition of alcohol, and virtually everyone out there listening understands that that was a complete failure. Although that only lasted 13 years, our prohibition against drugs has lasted over 90 years, and we find ourselves in a very similar situation as we did back in alcohol prohibition, where the crime and the corruption is at an all-time high, and our government has been unable to stem the flow of drugs into our country or the use of these drugs by our citizens, and they continue to tell us that they've got a handle on this and that they're beginning to win the war on drugs. And again, any thinking person in your audience understands that to be a complete lie.
The premise brought forward by the prohibitionists, the drug warriors, some 100 years ago by preachers and other do-gooders, has backfired to an enormous degree. Tell us what legalization might bring.
Well, I try to use the term repealing prohibition as opposed to legalization. I know it's semantics, but it really isn't splitting hairs. Alcohol at the end of prohibition was not declared a legal substance. What they did was repeal the prohibition against the manufacture and sale of this product. The same thing I advocate for the drug situation is that ending prohibition will not legalize these drugs, but it will allow the markets to return to a regulated format where adults can purchase these drugs without prescription and use them with all the common sense that we have, and eliminate up to 60% of our overall crime index. And that's the main issue that I put forward, is that I believe repealing drug prohibition will be the most significant law and order legislation of the 21st century.
Well, I think the ramifications are international, because not only would we stop that much crime in America, we would also defund the cartels and the terrorists and the violent folks out there that mean us harm.
Well, you're exactly right, Dean. The international implications would be, I can just give you two quickly here. If we were to repeal prohibition, we would bring greater stability to Afghanistan by allowing private companies to enter the opium market and regulate its sale throughout the world, and that would deprive the warlords in Afghanistan from continuing the heroin trade, and it would also give Afghanistan a legitimate agricultural crop. And in South America, if we were to repeal prohibition, large areas of that country would begin to become more stable. Coca production would go down to its earlier form, where just for localized consumption, and the drug cartels and the guerrilla armies would be deprived of literally hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue to continue their wars in South America. So those are just two areas that, on an international level, prohibition repeal would be greatly beneficial.
Now, if you'll excuse me, Daniel, I want to paraphrase a paragraph here from page 171 of your great book,
okay,
The Naked Truth About Drugs. The government can already demand we defecate in a plastic bag and urinate in a paper cup in their search for drug users. But such practices, as draconian and degrading as they are, catch less than 1% of the tens of millions of Americans who take drugs. In the all-out assault now being planned, prohibitionists want the other 99%. They're serious about this, aren't they? To this day, the halls of Congress, they're trying to find the whole 100%, aren't they?
Well, yes, they are. If you take a look at the increase in drug testing in the employment sector, in the school systems, they are desperately trying to identify all users of these substances, and again, they are catching less than 1%. There are statistics that pretty much say that over 85 million Americans have consumed an illegal substance at one time in their life. And if 85 million people have done that with little harm and little foul, it's pretty hard to extrapolate out that all drug users are losers and responsible for the majority of the crime in the United States. What I try to give in the book is I've tried to instill confidence in the reader that if we were to repeal drug prohibition, that will not lead to an addict nation. That is that's the granddaddy bluff of the prohibitionists out there, that if we repeal prohibition, we will turn into an addict nation. And what I'm trying to tell the people in that read my book is that back in the day before we had drug prohibition, when you could buy heroin from the Sears and Roebuck mail order catalog, the addiction rate in our country was less than 1.5%, which is identical to the addiction rate today after over 90 years of intense prohibition. So I'm just trying to give the reader confidence that if we were to repeal prohibition, all of the dire consequences that the prohibitionists tell us will happen will not happen, and that we will reduce the overall crime index by nearly 60%, which will be a stunning accomplishment and will literally impact every American citizen in the form of lower insurance rates, lower crime rates, better enforcement of the remaining crime, and we will have a situation where I think the majority of people will end up scratching their heads and wondering why we did not repeal drug prohibition at an earlier date.
Well, let's see. In closing, do you have a website? Is there a website you would recommend folks visit?
Well, thank you for the shameless plug. My book is available at Amazon.com and on my website, thenakedtruthaboutdrugs.com. And with regards to other advocacy groups out there, there are a bunch of them out there, but I believe even though their intentions are honorable and good, nobody really knows who they are. The Partnership for a Drug-Free America owns the airwaves, and I believe it's time for them to get a little competition out there and do some television public service announcements that advocate the repeal of drug prohibition with an emphasis on reducing the overall crime index in the United States.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
America's president and secretaries of state and defense have all cited Afghanistan as a model for their Iraq policy. In Afghanistan, a small number of American soldiers protect the fragile government, while, by oversight or design, their commanders stoke the engine of its economy, the illegal opium trade. Since the American invasion in 2001, Afghanistan has become the world's preeminent narco state, now producing nearly all of the world's black market opium and its derivative heroin. Opium production has risen exponentially under American occupation. Another record crop is forecast for the coming year. In contrast to Colombia, where approximately 2% of the economy is related to illegal drugs, as much as two-thirds of U.S.-occupied Afghanistan's economy derives from the production and distribution of contraband narcotics. Richard Holbrook, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, writes in this week's Washington Post that last year's very modest poppy eradication efforts cost America nearly $1 billion, more than the entire national budget of Afghanistan, and accomplished essentially nothing. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
It's not a holocaust. It's not genocide. It's not exactly an inquisition. This policy of drug war, hell-bent for eternity, has left more mass graves than any despot. Tens of millions of lives, not taken, but rather life potentials destroyed by our policy of drug prohibition. Prohibition promises to protect our children until they turn 17, when they become meat for the drug war grinder. So if prohibition's not genocide or a holocaust or an inquisition, just what the hell is it? The Drug Truth Network wants to know what word or phrase history will use when it looks back at this time. We offer our listeners $100 cash for the best suggestion for what that word might be. Please send your suggestion to dean@drugtruth.net. We'll announce the winner on May Day, May 1st, 2006. Next up, we hear from microbiologist Jeremy Bigwood. This story should be of great concern to all those who appreciate living in a world with green things growing all around.
My name's Jeremy Bigwood. I studied the chemistry of mushrooms and mycology in the university. Since then, I've had a MacArthur Foundation grant in 2000 to look into mycoherbicides, and I've been following the mycoherbicide issue ever since. And mycoherbicides are toxic fungi, in this case designed to eradicate drug crops.
And there is an attempt, once again, within Congress to perhaps allow for the use of these products. Tell us about that bill, if you will, sir.
Well, there's a bill in Congress that was part of the Reauthorization Act of the ONDCP, which is the Drug Czar's Office. There was a provision in that bill that the Drug Czar's Office had to draw up a plan to use mycoherbicides in a drug-produced, or to test mycoherbicides in a drug-producing country, obviously in the field. My feeling is that since these are organisms that can spread around once you apply them, that any testing, field testing, is essentially a use. One of the problems with this mycoherbicide situation is that these toxic fungi have already been rejected by most parts of the United States government. Anyone who studied it has determined that the use of these fungi is just too dangerous, too unpredictable, and everyone who's worked with them, from the CIA to the USDA, has come down against their use. The problem is that if Congress mandates this, and if this passes through the Senate, then ONDCP, even though they don't want to do this, the Drug Czar's Office is not behind this, they will have to find a country to test this. The problem is that the problem for them is that the most likely countries that are drug crop producing countries to test this in are Colombia and Afghanistan. And in both Colombia and Afghanistan, both governments are against the use of these mycoherbicides. So essentially it would be the U.S. government, against its better judgment, having to ram this program down the throats of other countries. The problems with these mycoherbicides that are being used to eradicate drug crops is that they contain, they're essentially little chemical factories. When you use a chemical herbicide against a plant, the chemical usually kills the plant and then usually goes away, or it degrades, or sometimes it doesn't degrade, and sometimes there are problems. With this, you're actually applying a living chemical factory that produces toxins that are toxic to all manners of all kinds of life forms, not just the target plant. So you're essentially applying something that is toxic to soils, it's toxic to, it could be toxic to humans. In one case, Fusarium oxysporum, which is the mycoherbicide which they would like to use against coca, That attacks a whole series of other plants. And right now in the United States, we have a Fusarium keratitis, it's called. It's an epidemic of Fusarium that's spreading through the United States and eating people's eyes, essentially, in a small way, of those people using contact lenses. So it's the material that they're interested in using has a very toxic history. In fact, for many years, it was investigated, and the compounds that Fusarium produces, especially something called T2 toxin, was isolated and weaponized and mass-produced and stored as a chemical warfare weapon. The other problem, another major problem with microherbicides, is that their use will be considered as biological warfare by most of the world. And if the U.S. unilaterally gets involved in biological warfare, its enemies are going to think that biological weapons are fair game. That is very, very dangerous. And that's a case where we have something that's designed for the drug war that will overlap into every other aspect of or could break out of just the drug war and become an issue that affects all of us.
I want to remind the listeners we're speaking with Jeremy Bigwood. He's the author of a new presentation. I think that was commissioned by the Drug Policy Alliance.
It was indeed, yes.
And folks would like to learn more about it, I urge them to visit the website of Drug Policy Alliance at drugpolicy.org. And read more about this very disturbing and potential problem here. Jeremy, as I understand it, there was an outbreak of one of these mycoherbicides. Was it in Peru? There was some dispute as to whether it was brought in by the DEA or not. But
it's very unclear.
And I guess the point I wanted to make is that some of the cocaine cartels took some of the plants that survived this outbreak and started using it in their production line, I suppose. So even if we were to use this, chances are it wouldn't even work in the first place, right?
Well, it may not work against, it wouldn't work in that case against those coca plants that were resistant to it. And it probably wouldn't work, but it would probably poison other crops, and it could also theoretically, if it mutated in a certain way, it could also attack mammals and humans, too. So you're absolutely right. It may not even have the desired effect, and yet it would have all of these other effects. But most importantly, any use in Colombia, first of all, the Colombian government's against it. Second of all, they've actually signed international accords saying that they won't use it. That's another thing. And even so, there are members of the U.S. Congress who think that even if Colombia is against it, and even if they've signed international accords against it, that if the United States wants to spray, the United States should be able to spray. I mean, it's just beyond the pale. Well, basically, I think what people need to do is to contact their senators and ask them to not vote for this proposal, but vote against it if it comes up as part of a Senate bill. And ideally, it would not come up. Ideally, that they should work to not even allow this to come up as a Senate bill.
All right. And again, I think there's ways and means to do that available at the drugpolicy.org website.
Exactly.
In the past few weeks, the story about immigration has made national headlines, bringing focus to bear on the tie-in between the smugglers of human beings and the smugglers of drugs. Here to talk about it is a man with 32 years' experience as a federal official, as a border guard, as a customs agent, and who works now as a spokesman for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc.
Yeah, this is Terry Nelson speaking from LEAP. Illegal alien problems and how to deal with them are sometimes being confused with illegal drug problems. You hear Governor Napolitano of Arizona say, build a $50 million radar and keep out drug traffickers. Gee, why don't we just legalize drugs and you won't have drug traffickers and the illegal problem will still be there. So that's not a solution. And I can't see where installing the National Guard along the border would be more efficient than the Border Patrol. The solution would be to make the Border Patrol do their jobs and utilize roadblocks, traffic checks, etc., and make it, you know, more difficult for the aliens to get across, because they're going to come anyway. And they would be able to do that if they weren't, you know, we're not spending so much of their time looking for dope. But then, of course, to a cop, it's much more exciting to make a drug arrest than an illegal alien. I guess, realistically, you will not be able to stop the illegal entrants from coming to America as long as there's an economic benefit for them to come. The problem is the coddling of the corrupt central government of Mexico by our State Department. For the first time that I can remember, the American dollar sent into Mexico was their leading economic indicator, followed by oil and tourism. The most probable solution, as I see it, is to legalize drugs, take the profit and criminal element out of it, and then Mexico can gain some control of their country again, you know, and like Laredo is a shining example of that. They have, we know who controls Laredo. With less corruption, the good Mexicans that want to help their people can be more successful, and it would certainly remove most of the violence in the border area. Of course, I'm not going to tell you there would still be desperate coyotes and workers that would resort to violence, you know, against the Border Patrol as they see they're being stopped and detained as a direct threat to their livelihood and a way to make a living for their families. But again, the military will not fix this problem. It's an economic and social one that requires more than putting up a fence or throwing them in jail. And the Mexican government is not doing anything to reduce the amount of aliens coming. Mexico is not a poor country. The last time I was down in central Mexico, it wasn't. We have the problems along the border based upon the economic condition of Mexico, and the only solution, in my humble opinion, is to improve the economic conditions of Mexico. Instead of, you can't build a fence, they'll dig under it, pole vault over it, and fly over it. It hasn't worked, and it won't work, and it's just another waste of American taxpayers' dollars. Bring some political pressure on Mexico to make some changes. Take better care of their people, you know, some social programs down in Mexico instead of just corrupting and making more billionaires in Mexico City.
Speaking of billionaires in Mexico City, next week on the Cultural Baggage Program, our guest will be Catherine Austin Fitz, who draws a direct connection between the U.S. bankers and the international drug lords. And another quick reminder to the producers out there on the Drug Truth Network, next week, we will be releasing a 90-minute report, 3 29-minute, if need be, independent segments about the conference on cannabis therapeutics being held in Santa Barbara this week. And I'm serious about that offer of $100. If you've got an idea what history will call this time of eternal drug war when we look back at it, please send an email to dean@drugtruth.net. Just enough time to remind any cop or district attorney, any judge or agent of the DEA, CIA, FBI, or Justice Department who's willing to come on the program and defend the policy of eternal drug war, I've got $1,200 cash to reward your courage to defend the policy by which you live. There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. We have been duped. Please do your part to help end this inquisition. Visit our website, inprohibition.org. Prohibido istak ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker, asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.